Okay, everyone, welcome to episode 60 of the Great Divide podcast. I cannot believe that we have done 60 episodes, but we haven't done 60 yet. This is our 60th, but it's hard to believe, but it's been fun. It still is fun. And welcome my co-host, as always, Svein from Norway. Hello, Svein.
Hello. Happy 60.
Happy 60th to you. It seems like just yesterday we were celebrating our 50th.
Yeah, that's been pretty quick.
Yeah, very quick.
It's been rushing by with a flurry of episodes.
Well, we have something that's even better than anything we did on the 50th today for everyone. And so we'll just shut up and introduce our special guest. And that is the return of the one-headed king himself, Bruce Watson, is joining us today.
Hi, guys. How are you doing? Happy 60th.
Thank you very much.
When we turn 60 in the UK, we get a free bus pass and we can travel anywhere in the UK absolutely free. So I'm just waiting on mine.
That's great. Oh, that's very nice.
Nice.
Well, Bruce, I mean, did you ever think that a podcast about you and your band would even start and number two would last for 60 episodes?
No, never in 60 years would I have dreamt that one up. You know what I mean? It's only recently I found out what a podcast was, you know.
Right, yeah. Yeah, me too, actually, not too long ago. But, we're thrilled to have you as always. It's awesome.
You need to clock up the amount of hours you've done over those 60 podcasts, and I bet you it's insane.
That's John's job.
Well, he has to do something, doesn't he?
We could do it because we've got, all of them up and the time for each one of them is listed, so I'm afraid to look at it, to be honest.
Yeah, well, John, you can count up the hours. In fact, I bet it runs into days.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt.
I think anything you say, boss.
I think the Steel Town series that we did alone ran into days. So anyway,
Buffalo Skinner's was 12 hours alone.
Oh my gosh, this is crazy. Yeah, we talked about that for 12 hours. Anyway,
God,
not at once. But anyway, we're so excited to have Bruce here today. We've got some questions of our own to ask him, and we've got some of our listener questions that they sent in. So we've picked some of the non-filthy ones maybe we'll have some filthy ones too to ask.
Okay.
But I guess the best place to start is sort of where we left off on the show last time, which was talking about the Australian tour. I mean, we never really got your perspective on it. So what's your takeaway from that whole experience, finally getting to Australia and performing all of those shows?
I absolutely loved every single minute of it. I mean, to get this bit out of the way, the worst bit is actually getting there and coming home, because the flight is just pure torture. It's, a day and a half or whatever it was. But, I mean, we got down to New Zealand. I mean, that was the first port of call. So you can imagine how horrendous the flight was getting there. But once we got there and we had a day and a half off to acclimatise and kind of got in, and obviously adrenaline keeps you going as well. I mean, I loved the place. I did not have one single kind of bad moment in Australia and New Zealand, apart from occasionally, the jet lag kicking in. I thought the people were amazing. Some of the clubs that we played at were just fantastic, you know, and hopefully we'll get back there. They're talking about in between doing it a year to 18 months and going back and doing more shows. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Oh, that's awesome. It seemed like the reception that you guys got too was, I mean, if you heard the last podcast, I think you did it. You could probably hear that in the voices and the stories of the guests that we had. But it seemed like they were just so thrilled to finally have you on their soil and to be able to see you. I mean, did you get that feeling from the crowd? Were they a little bit even more into it than maybe you're used to because you hadn't been there for so long?
I mean, I think so, yeah. And a lot of people turned up, similar age group to ourselves, where they had like copies of the original ticket stubs and adverts from local papers where it said we should have been out there way back in 1980, whatever it was meant to be, you know. And it's like, well, that's 30 odd years ago. It's, you know, it's crazy. Why didn't we why didn't we come out here? You know, it's the same way America as well. You know, we always do the UK quite a lot, obviously, because it's convenient. We live here. But, you know, we've been out to other places, you know, played in the Arctic Circle at one point as well, you know. So it's like, why we never went there and why we didn't tour America as much as what we should have done. But you can't do two places at the one time, you know. But now that we've done it and we know that we can do it, it's we're definitely going back, definitely.
So you've done Australia after a lot of years. How about other exotic markets? Do you have anything in your sight? I know you have a fan group in Brazil. I'm just asking to preempt some questions later while we're sort of in the jet-lagged part of the show.
Okay, Luke. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy to go most places. But again, it's down to whether a promoter is willing to take the chance. I mean, obviously, we've never been out to South America. I don't know how well our records did out there, or if they even know of us in South America. For speaking to the guys in Nazareth, who are obviously from Dunfermline, they're out in South America quite a lot. But they've obviously had hits out there. So really, it's just down to our agent getting in touch with promoters in different countries and seeing if anything's going to stick. I mean, I never thought we'd have got to Australia and New Zealand. But right, our agent got in touch with people out there. I think some promoters thought it might have been a bit risky, but other promoters thought, no, let's try it, and if it works, we'll bring the guys back. So it's just a matter of other people having a bit of faith in what you can do, you know?
Right, so this is a challenge we're sending out to the super fans in all these locations. Contact your local promoters, see if they're interested, connect them to Big Country's booking agent, and take it from there.
Yeah, and you never know, we might be touring Scandinavia, but who knows? That would be good.
You might have a fan or two up here too.
Yeah. I know at least one.
Nice.
You have quite a few.
I just wanted to jump right into the Seer because, I mean, that's the big thing on the horizon. And I know that you said, and I saw a post from Scott Whitley earlier today where he said the band was going into full rehearsals next week.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about how those rehearsals are going. I know you probably haven't had the band versions yet, but how have you been preparing for this?
It's similar to what we did with the Steeltown stuff and even the Crossing stuff or whenever we do something new. Basically, because we're geographically all over the shop in the UK, it's Jamie and myself, we go into our little studio and we do our homework. Scott does it on his own, and Simon does it on his own, and Mark, I think, is going into a rehearsal room on his own this week to work on the drums. And what happens is the procedure for Jamie and I, obviously, is guitars. So we kind of work out who's going to do what part. What overdubs, obviously, we're going to have to leave out because you need four guitars or whatever. So we work out the main basics, watch a bit of YouTube footage of what Stuart and I were doing back then, and we just take it from there. And what we're going to do is next week we go into a rehearsal studio for 2 days. And the reason we do that is basically it's just to work out backing vocals, who's going to do what, and how to start a song and how to end a song, you know, because when you've recorded a song or written a song in a studio and recorded it, you don't know how to end it half the time. And that's why there's a lot of fades, you know, and it's like, oh, we just faded it out because we didn't know how to end it. So you kind of work. It's all that kind of stuff that you do when you get into rehearsals and work out who's going to do which harmony, because there's certain voices work for certain harmonies and certain ones that don't. So that's the reason for that. Musically, it's all taken care of because the homework's done beforehand. So musically, it's just like, yeah, that's fine. But it's mainly vocals, backing vocals.
Oh, wow. That's really an interesting point I hadn't thought of. That makes total sense. Well, let me ask you this, because I know that when the album came out, I remember reading some interviews and Stuart was saying how there was a lot more space musically in the album versus Steeltown that preceded it.
Yep.
Did you feel that too as you were relearning these parts and going through the pieces? Was it easier than when you had to relearn Steeltown and learn the parts for that?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. On Steeltown, because the mix was really dense and there was so much going on, it was kind of hard to pick out what was going on with certain guitar parts. And I used to put the track on and I'd put it into a sound processing program on the computer and just mess around with the frequencies to pick out certain things. But Scott turned me onto an interesting thing. He gave me this program, and it's quite a naff kind of program. It's for karaoke singers, right? And what you do is it removes the vocals from songs.
Wow.
But what you can do is you can pan it left and right, and as you're doing that, it brings up certain things, certain guitar parts or certain bass things. The vocals kind of, they disappear when it's in the middle, but when you move it to the left or right, the vocals come back in, but also other overdubs come back in, and it's like, wow, I forgot about that bit. You know, it's like, I think it was on the Red Fox, and I was trying to work out, there's two twin harmony guitars going on towards the end of Red Fox, and I'm going, which one did I play and which one did Stuart play? And I was like, trying to work it out, and I went further and further over to the right of the spectrum, and all of a sudden a slide guitar overdub came out that I did. And I'd completely forgotten all about it, you know, and it was just, oh my God, there's an acoustic slide overdub right at the very end, which obviously we're not going to do that, but it was kind of buried in the mix. But
you know, Bruce, I'm sure the Miller mix pronounced that slide guitar.
It probably would have done. It probably would have done. It's like a fantastic jigsaw puzzle. And it's very daunting when you start, but once you get into it, it becomes fun, you know.
You probably have a song on the album that you're looking forward to getting into and playing live, and you probably have one that you sense is a bit of work, and you kind of indicate that Red Fox was one of those. But is there one that you're particularly looking forward to?
I'm actually looking forward to doing the ones that, like Steel Town, I'm looking forward to doing the ones that were never performed by the principal lineup. Mm. Just because we had so many songs back then, and you can only, I think because we had all the hits on the first album, you can't not do them. But it was great doing things like The Great Divide from the Steel Town album last year. So I think this time round, it's definitely going to be like The Sailor and Red Fox, I think, are going to be the ones I'm really looking forward to doing, you know?
Mm, yeah. That,
and also Look Away.
Nice, definitely. Hey, I'm so excited to hear The Sailor, especially. So I'm completely with you there. That's going to be quite a moment. I think a lot of people are excited to hear that one. That's such an epic song. Well, I mean, Bruce, as you've gone through these, have you kind of revisited or rediscovered any memories you had of that period? What's your feeling of the album as a whole now that you've kind of really dissected it? Have you thought about it more lately than you have in years?
Yeah, but I haven't actually thought about what was going on at the time. But there's a few memories. I mean, obviously, Look Away. I mean, funnily enough, that was the backing track for that was recorded at Rack Studios. And I'd forgotten all about that until I got back in. And I went, well, hold on a minute. We did do that at Rack. I think it was in the winter. And we kind of broke up after that for the holidays. And then we went back into the power plant. So even when you hear Mark's drums on that, you can actually hear the sound of the room, you know, the same place as we did The Crossing. Obviously, the title track, The Seer, with Kate Bush, was just absolutely amazing. And I would still like to get hold of Robin's mix on that, because her voice, it was a proper duet between Kate Bush and Stuart. But obviously, as we all know, on the remix, which is the one that came out, her voice is kind of buried a little bit. But I was doing an interview today with Classic Rock magazine, and it just came into my head. The guy was asking about memories of Kate Bush and how it came about. And I said, well, basically, we were listening to some Kate Bush stuff, and Stuart had said, like, it wouldn't be great if we could get somebody like Kate Bush to sing on this track this year. And Robin went, oh, I'll just get in touch with the record company and phone her up. And, you know, and that's what happened. And we sent her a cassette, and she came in maybe a few days later or a week later, did the track. And it was weird because in the power plant, the control room was up the stairs, and the studio room was down the stairs. And Kate would do, you know, a few lines of a song, and then she would stop. And then you would hear this kind of scratching sound. And I'm going, what's that scratching sound? And look at the glass window, and she's, after every take, she was lighting up a cigarette, you know? And I was like, wow.
That's great. That's so funny. Now, you did say memories of Kate Bush, right?
Mm.
Not memories.
No, I said memories.
Okay, I'm just kidding you.
I didn't look. It would be rude to look. It would be very, very ungentlemanly.
Well, you know, Robin Miller is on record as referencing those as being magnificent. That's what he said. So
yes, but Robin's
he's
eyesight,
blind, right?
Yes.
I know. I thought that was strange too.
Well, Robin's the only guy that I know that used to come up at his work with odd socks. And he would sit, he wouldn't mind me saying this, he would sit at the mixing desk, and Robin used to smoke cigarettes as well, and Will Gosling would be to his right-hand side mixing, and with Robin being partially blind at the time, he could never find the ashtray, so he would always stub his cigarette out. It was always on Will's hand, you know, as he was mixing, and all you could hear was, "Ah, Robin!" Ah.
Now, was he blind then completely, or was he in the process of losing his sight? I mean, how did that work?
I think it was partially at that time.
Okay. So he could maybe see enough or maneuver enough to do what he needed to do, I guess, to...
Yeah, he still needed assistance as well, though, but I think it obviously got worse as the, you know, the further it went on. Right. I haven't spoken with Robin for a little while now, so I'm not really sure.
Right, right. Wow. Mm.
But what a great guy. And to me, it was like a breath of fresh air, you know, just getting in that studio with Robin and putting those songs together. And it was really got right into the arrangements and parts and stuff like that, you know. And I had a cassette of the Robin's mix, and it's just got lost in the midst of time, you know. But as we now know, it's like the history with that album. I mean, I could maybe have come across as having like gripes about it, but the mix and stuff like that, but or Dave Bates, but the thing is, Dave Bates was probably right. We had three hits off that record, so
right,
you know. Robin's mix sounded more like what we sound like live. It didn't have the big reverby drum sounds and, you know, that sort of Rev 7. You can tell all the instruments and all the effects that were used. It's, you can just hear them, you know.
You know, while we're on the subject of his mix, I mean, you know that we put together a petition a while back, and we still get signatures on that, electronic signatures. I mean, as recently as I think just a week ago, people were still signing that thing. And I think it's up to about 1,500 signatures at this point.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, but the problem that we run into is like we don't know what to do with it. We don't know who to give it to, who to send it to. I mean, I know this is something that needs to come from the fans, and it's not something that needs to come from the band, but is there any contact or anything or anyone that you know who we could make aware of it, so at least someone at Universal or wherever might be aware of it?
Yeah, I could definitely put some feelers out, although I don't have any clout in that department, but there's maybe one guy I know that could maybe help out, or maybe, you know, could be a key person. So I could maybe mention it to that person, but again, it's, I mean, I don't know, is Universal still the record label? I don't know, they always seem to change, as you know. Stuff comes out now like every other year, and it's like it's never been sanctioned by the band, and it's always, you know, I think there's a new one out with the first five albums, but we don't, because we don't own any of that, and or any of that, it just goes out anyway. At least with Universal, they used to get in touch and ask for our involvement and, you know, maybe sourcing some rare photos or sleeve notes and stuff. But other stuff comes out as well, and it could be licensed by other companies that we were signed with, a track or whatever. And we don't really have any say in it, eh? So they just kind of come out. But there's never ever anything new on them. It's just the same old stuff, but with a slightly different sleeve, you know, and that's about it. And, but people still buy them, but I always think, well, how many copies do you want off No Place Like Home or, you know, anything, something like that, when there's nothing, anything new on it?
Well, my co-host wants every copy that's released, I can tell you that.
It's underway.
Right. He's a big collector of these things, so yes.
Of all these things, right.
Apparently that version of No Place Like Home is unique because the first half of Kansas is missing.
Are you serious?
What? That's what someone said. The first half of Kansas is missing. So,
oh my lord!
Quality job. You have to appreciate it.
Yeah, but that's a collector's item.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Certainly, it's justified.
See, there should be some sort of quality control. I mean, if they got the principal members from the band involved, you wouldn't run into that kind of problem, you know. But
check for typos and
oh yeah, typos are good. All that kind of stuff. But people are lazy these days. It's like, we'll just Wikipedia, we'll Google, you know. And it's, there you go. That's out there in the public domain, so it must be true or whatever, you know. It's just nuts. It's just laziness.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah. you know, there's a. I'm curious if you're aware of this. There's a CD coming out that's a compilation of some of the gigs that you guys did in 2011. It's of a live CD. Swine could probably answer more about this than me as far as information. But yeah, they had like a track listing, and the very first track was labeled 1,000 Years. So instead of 1,000 Stars.
Right.
And so I don't know if you're even aware of that being released, but it's apparently like a very small run of CDs. I think they said only 200 they were releasing, or 150 or something. But right.
That's a bit bizarre, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, strange.
Has it been released before in this album in any shape or form?
No, as far as I know, it hasn't. I know
it has.
Oh, it has. Okay.
Yes, basically that's the couple of the gigs that were recorded and sold the same night.
USB sticks.
No. These were CDs. This was the year before that. They did a couple of shows. One was in Sheffield. One was in London. And you downloaded the third CD later on. They've kind of culled those two shows together to make one alleged best of thing.
I don't know nothing about that one, but
that's so strange that, you know, you guys aren't even consulted for some of these things.
It's bizarre, but hey, well, it's just I'm kind of used to it. Although I shouldn't be used to it, but you know, life's too short to go about, you know, threatening legal action, or if legal action was needed. I don't know where it's come from.
Right.
Who's licensed it to who? So.
Okay.
But,
well,
but even though you don't own these releases or can't stop them, do you at least get a pittance from the sales of them?
What are you referring to, money? No.
Pittance means something else in Norway.
Right, no, bugger all, we call it. Welcome to bugger all, that's it.
Oh, that stinks. That really stinks. Yeah. Well, you know, we'll move on from the seer here, but I just wanted to, you know, bring that up about the mix. So yeah, if there's anyone that you think might help with that, you know, feel free to send them my way. I'll contact them or whatever, but.
Right, I'll get the old thinking cap on. There's one person I've got in mind, but we'll see what happens. Okay.
And didn't you find like a reel-to-reel recording at one point? I think
we did a gig for the fourth Roadbridge celebrations over in Queens Ferry, and one of the guys in the support band, a band called Wanny Junction, their manager turned up and he just gave me this reel-to-reel, you know, 2-inch reel-to-reel, the Power Plant label, and there was three tracks on it and they were definitely Robin Miller mixes. And he goes, I was working down at the Power Plant and they were basically going in the skip. And whoever, the studio manager, says, do you want this? And the guy went, well, yeah, I'm up in Edinburgh, so if I come across any of the guys from Big Country, I'll hand it in. And he had it for years. And that's basically what he did. He gave me the reel-to-reel.
Oh, wow. Wow. So what can you do with that? Is there like...
I'll probably bake it. But you have to bake it to stop it oxidizing. You could actually, if you had somebody, a studio that had, you know, a studer or, you know, a 2-inch reel-to-reel machine, you could actually go in and mix it, you know, and stick it on a Pro Tools or something like that, and then you've got, yeah, it's digitized, and then you could mix individual tracks. But I don't know who's got. I mean, it's not legally. It's probably not even mine. But you know, I was going to go into a skip anyway. So it's in my attic.
Oh, that's great. Well, yeah. It's at least nice to know that something exists from that.
Yeah.
I hope we get to hear it one day.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what track. I think I emailed you what tracks were on it, but I can't even remember what tracks are on it now. But it might have been One Great Thing. I don't know.
I think it might have been. I have to go back.
I think it was One Great Thing.
But wow. Well, that's awesome. Do you know if there's anything, I'm sure we've asked this before, but I just for clarification purposes, is there anything left over from those sessions that might be unreleased or
Nah, definitely not.
Okay.
No, but that was for that period, there wasn't much done in the way of demoing. Same with Steeltown as well. It was all kind of a little cassette player, ghetto blaster kind of thing in front of Mark's drum kit. And that's how those two albums are kind of demoed. So there wasn't really any, not like in the later days with the Why the Long Face stuff in Damascus, there wasn't excessive demoing going on in various little studios. So
right.
So okay. No, I don't think there's anything.
Okay.
Unless there's some live gigs that are in a vault somewhere, but I can't remember.
I think we want to jump a bit forward now to well into next year. There's been planned a weekend, I believe, in May in Dunfermline, a big country convention. What can we say about that?
That's been penciled in, but it won't be happening. It's going to the convention thing was kind of provisionally booked for then, but timing's not going to allow it, and people's scheduling's not going to allow it. So what we're going to do is we're going to put it back to the following year, but it'll be a different month.
Ah, okay. So it's not going to be happening this May.
No, I think what's happened is it's up on the agent's website, and he's been on holiday and he hasn't taken it down.
Oh, okay.
So basically that there was going to be a convention, but because there's a few timing issues, it's not going to work out for everybody. So it really should have been taken down, which I shall tell him about. But there will be a convention at some point, and it is being discussed at the moment and it's being worked on at the moment. But until we get the five guys, you know, it's kind of holiday times as well, you know, so we need to get the five guys to come up with a date that we can all manage. Because a convention, it's not like being a normal gig. We want to do something a little bit special and a little bit different. So there's going to have to be rehearsal time in that. So the May thing didn't work out for that. But there will be one, definitely.
Good. Wonderful. Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because I just saw today the dates and I was thinking about getting tickets. And
we all started planning immediately, which is a good thing.
Well, we see the Rock Artist Management site, it's not actually for sort of like public viewing, kind of, although it is, but it's mainly for agents talking to promoters, so that it's like a diary kind of thing, although anybody can have a look at it. But there's gigs there, all the gigs, they're not written in stone, they're kind of being spoken about, you know, and sort of 90% of them happen, but 10% of them don't, and it's just because somebody might not be available for whatever reason, you know. So never take that as the gospel. Always stick with John's information for the gospel.
That's what nice. We do. That's what we do. If it doesn't come from John, it's not real.
Yeah.
And speaking of John, he has an update from the sideline on how long all the podcasts are all put together. So, John, tell us how long they all are.
3 days, 16 hours, 34 minutes.
That's great.
And running.
That's actually shorter than I anticipated.
Well, actually, it was 33 minutes and 57 seconds, but I rounded it up to 34.
Yeah, so if you wanted to have some sort of charity marathon listening session to all the podcasts, it's...
My wife is still asking me, you know, as much as she loves you guys, she still says, you still have topics to talk about? Yes, we do. We have not gone through all the albums yet, but we will.
Have we not went through all the albums yet?
We still have Damascus and Peace in Our Time to do.
Oh, my goodness. Right.
Yeah, so those are a couple big ones.
Oh, what?
And I haven't talked about The Crossing.
Yeah, we might even redo The Crossing, since the very first episodes, which were just me alone, was The Crossing. So
I think we should have an hour-long special just on Look Away.
Nice.
Oh, we already did that one. And I think that might even have been an hour.
Yeah, that's to come. Shut up! So, Bruce, is it okay if we launch into a few of these fan questions?
Yeah, let's go for it, yeah.
All right, good. And I thought this was an interesting question. This is from Simon Wooten. And he says, if Big Country had played Live Aid, do you have any idea in 1985 which three songs you would have done? Which three songs you would have picked?
So 85, it would have been Well, we'd have still been doing the crossing stuff, eh? So I'm assuming if it had happened, it would have been...
I think Steel Town had come out then, I think.
Steel Town was out, and Restless Natives was out too.
Okay.
Yeah, well, no, I can tell you right now, if we had done Live Aid, it would have been the usual suspects, Chance and A Big Country and Fields of Fire.
Gotcha.
That's what it would have been.
Good. Oh, well, that
you can't be too clever about these things, you know?
That's right. That would have been an awesome set. All right, good. That was an easy one.
Nice one. So we'll go back to the Seer 30th anniversary right now, because Jason Allen is asking, will you be recording any of those shows?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I think it would be great. I mean, sometimes things like the Australian thing just kind of happened off the cuff. We only found out about it about a week beforehand. And it was Jamie, actually, the guy, Chris, who was a studio engineer, he just got in touch with Jamie. And Jamie just asked the guys in the band, this guy wants to record it with a professional setup. He's just recorded stuff with Midge. So we looked at the stuff they'd done with Midge online, and it sounded fantastic. We thought, yeah, let's do it. So we haven't actually made a plan to record anything from this year, but you never know. It may happen.
Right. So what you just said is you do have a great recording from Australia.
Well, I haven't listened to it, but if it's anything like the stuff the guy did with Midge, then, you know, it should be good. And it's all the individual tracks. It's not like a desk recording. He recorded it. So we've got all the original stems. So we can mix them once they arrive.
Right. So that's what you're waiting for from Australia.
Yes. Yep.
Got it.
Well, he doesn't want to send them digitally. He doesn't want to send them over the net. So he's going to send hard copies.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I hope that works out.
Yeah, and hopefully.
Worst case scenario, I hope you guys, you know, might just do a soundboard recording of a couple of the shows just to have them, you know, for posterity's sake. Because it's,
yeah, I mean, I came across a couple of kind of soundboard Steel Town ones as well, you know, so from the last Steel Town tour we did with Derek as well.
Oh, yeah.
So there's that kicking around somewhere as well. But, I mean, they're good for reference because, for instance, if I have to go and do Come Back to Me Again or whatever, I can go back and go, right, what did I play? What did Jamie play? And just reference it from that, you know?
Fantastic. And sort of tagging onto that, Jürgen Cole asks if you guys would ever consider playing a song like Song of the South from the Seer, kind of a B-side from the Seer era, or is it pretty much going to be strictly the tracks that were on the official album?
No, it's strictly the 10 tracks on that album. Basically because we've still got all the rest of the songs that were kind of successful before that, as well as whatever else we're going to put in there. So no, we're not going to touch Song of the South. We're just basically doing the 10 tracks from the Seer and then other songs.
Great.
Right. Moving right along, Colin Clancy is asking what you think is your favorite cover version that Big Country ever did.
Oh, well, obviously we used to play Don't Fear the Reaper live, so that was always good. And we used to do Oh Well, the Fleetwood Mac song. They were great fun to play live, but I've kind of got a soft spot for the two Alice Cooper songs that we did as well. They were good. And I liked Black Skin Blue Eye Boys, The Equals. That was good.
The Alice Cooper one, that was I'm 18, and what was the other
Teenage,
one?
Teenage Lament.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Okay, great. I remember Teenage Lament now. I really like that version too.
Yeah, we never played it live. It was more, again, kind of, it was a fashionable thing to do back then. Everybody was doing covers albums.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, by the way, we did do a covers episode, and we counted them, and you've actually done 35 covers, by the way.
Wow.
You've got to be kidding. Oh, yeah, if you include all the eclectic stuff.
Yeah, everything way back to, I think, Track of My Tears and Prairie Rose and all the way up to now.
Right. I mean, even the eclectic stuff, I mean, all those cover versions were kind of, like, we did Yellow Taxi, but that was mainly because Carol was singing it, Carol Waller. And it was a song she knew, and you know, so that was the reason we did those kind of covers. They weren't really indicative of what we would normally cover.
Okay, so David Brown has this next question, and I don't know if you remember, Bruce, but when you guys were rehearsing for the Steel Town tour, you sent us very kindly, I might add, a couple of the tracks that you and Jamie had worked up, where Jamie's guitar on one side, yours on the other.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you sent us like "Girl with Gray Eyes" and something else. Those were really, really popular among the people that listened to the show. They just loved it. So David Brown is asking, do you have any of those types of things for your preparation for the Seer tour that you'd be able to share?
Oh, right. Kind of. Yeah, I do actually, but they're not as kind of well thought out as the Steel Town ones. What Jamie and I do is, we get the Porter Studio out, the old famous Porter Studio, and basically stick in the stereo tracks of the 10 songs we're going to be learning. And it's only, I've got this is a little four-track Porter Studio, not the bigger one. So you've got track one and two is basically left and right off the record. And then what I'll do is I'll work out my guitar part, and I'll go into track three, and Jamie will work out Stuart's or his, or a combination of mine and Stuart's, and that'll go on track four. But because it's only a four track, you've got to do it in one live pass. Because if you're going to be playing the song live, you want to be able to play that song live, you know, all the way through. So, I mean, that's why I think Jamie put a thing up when he was playing the Seer the other day, and he played it great, and then at the very end he put this huge howler of a note in.
Yeah, I saw that video, yeah.
Yeah, so it's all that kind of stuff, eh? So it's just learning, it's just pure repetition, but... Yeah, there probably is a few bits and bobs on the Porter Studio, but I mean, I don't know what we're going to do with them. It's mainly for reference.
Right. Well, whatever you want to do is fine. I mean, if you don't want to share those, we totally understand. But just to let you know, those were people were really fascinated by that because they could really make out, I think, for the first time, some of those parts, and it was very interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the guitar parts did get buried because, you know, when you're recording a song and then it's overdubbed and another overdub. And some of the parts, they have to be buried or taken out altogether because, you know, you're eating into all these different frequencies. So, that's Gordon Smith texting me there. Sorry, where were we?
Oh, no problem. No,
I just want to, for the record, I'd love to hear one of those versions of the Red Fox. That's a personal request of mine. I think that's my favorite song of this year.
Right, do you want me and Jamie to do a
Red Fox? Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You won't get the drums or the bass. You'll just get two guitars.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be fine.
That was the one we were working on today.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, Bruce, you're talking to people who have spent 3 days and what was it, like 5 hours or whatever, talking about your output already. So we're not gonna care about, you know, not having drums and bass and some of these
right,
things.
Well, I'll get one together maybe in a few days and I'll fire it up.
Okay.
Absolutely fantastic.
That would be great. That would be great.
All right. We have a two-part question really from Curtis Holtzen, who is also a big Alarm fan. So it's a two-part question. And one of them is whether you keep in touch with Mike, how long it's been since you spoke with him, how things are between the two of you.
I'm absolutely fine with Mike, and I think he's absolutely fine with me. Absolutely no problem with Mike whatsoever. We've exchanged emails not too recently, but a little while back, and it was a kind of good news thing that he was sending me anyway. And some of the guys went to see the Alarm when they played with the Stranglers recently as well.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with Mike. I've absolutely got no problem. I'd even work with Mike again, you know. Absolutely no problem.
Absolutely. And the second part is more about your thoughts on The Journey, a few years removed from that album.
I still like The Journey. I think there's some good stuff on it. And I think looking back, that album definitely came about because Jamie and I had a stockpile of material that we'd saved up on the Porter Studios. And I think Mike also had a stockpile of material. And the enthusiasm that was there between us all, and I think the stars were aligned as well, and we just got in the studio and just knuckled down and just did it, you know, and it was. I think the chemistry was right for that period.
Mm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, this is a question that has come from more than one person, so I won't assign any name to it, but and you've I'm sure heard this before, but what are the band's plans, if any, for any new music coming down the road?
Well, I would like to record some new music. It's kind of awkward at the moment because, again, we're geographically all over the place, and also last year was just, we had to concentrate on Steel Town. This year we're going to concentrate on the Seer. But without dwelling on this, the two band members have had illnesses as well. Not that I want to broadcast what it was or whatever, but there has had to be time out, you know, and it's like, I think health is more important than new material. But if new material, if it happens, it happens. But obviously, I write, Jamie writes, we all write, you know, so it's just a matter of when the time's right. It's not that we're shirking away from writing songs. It's just there's been a lot of circumstances. So
no, that's got to be so hard too. I mean, when everyone is so far removed from each other, I mean, that's very difficult.
And I think the older you get as well, I mean, it's like, you know, the older you get, it's life becomes a bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more responsibilities and more things happen because you're getting older and stuff like that. So there's certain things that you've just got to leave out. You know, an athlete can't, a football player can't do what he did, you know, 30 years ago. You know, we're kind of lucky we can still play music, you know. But an athlete or somebody that does something quite strenuous, because your body's older, you can't do it.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. Nope, that's okay. A good answer. Thank you.
And yet another question about people you've worked with in the past. That's obviously a very interesting question, I guess. So this is about Tony, and I guess I'll approach it the same way as Mike. Have you been in touch? Are you talking? And are there plans to work together? And there's one specific angle to that where someone claims, I don't remember this, but someone claims that you said Tony had agreed to participate in a big country convention, which was news to me.
I don't remember that. But no, I mean, Tony and I communicate at least every 3 months. You know, there's always something comes up, you know, regarding big country business from the past. But no, I don't have a problem with Tony, and he doesn't have a problem with me. It's just that Tony retired. But, I mean, Tony has, you've got to remember, even way back in the 90s, Tony was kind of teaching part-time, and he's obviously enjoys doing that, you know, and I just don't think he wants to go out the road as much as what he did. And also, you know, the way the band ended up with Ian and the other members, Tony and Ian just kind of, you know, that they went that way and Mark and I went the other way.
Right.
No, I don't have a problem with Tony or even Ian, to be honest with you. I'm quite happy to be in their company, and yeah, I would do stuff with Tony again without a doubt. In fact, Mark played on some of Tony's stuff recently.
Yeah, the new Dog album.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's great. That's
I don't have a problem with any of that kind of stuff.
Awesome. Well, let me ask you, this is a little bit just for me, but about the current bass player, because I think Scott Whitley has really endeared himself quite a bit to the fan base because he just seems so energetic, so excited to be there, and he's a fantastic bass player. So, I mean, what was it that got you guys to choose him, and what are your thoughts on working with him?
I love working with Scott. He's a great guy, a great bass player. The reason we ended up working with Scott is we'd actually done some recording down at the studio that he worked at, and we got on really well with him. And then I found out that he was actually the bass player in the Animals at the time, and just watched them playing bass and stuff like that. But obviously Derek was still in the band at the time as well, but I just thought, this guy, and even Derek was saying, this guy's amazing. He's just a great bass player and a lovely guy, you know. And then when we needed a bass player, obviously Scott was the first choice, but he was still committed to the Animals. And Matt Pegg was free. And so we kind of went with Matt, but because Matt is more... He's a well-respected blues player, but Matt only plays really with his fingers, and obviously the Tony Butler bass lines were always done with a pick, apart from the Seer, which was slap. But we needed somebody that would do that. And another thing as well about Scott plays short scale bass, and funnily enough, half the songs and the crossings, when Stuart and I worked together, we wrote them on a short scale bass.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, but it does sound like a precision. Even though he's got this short scale bass, it just sounds full scale. So we wanted Scott anyway, but, you know, like I said, he was committed to the Animals. And then he just said, well, it's fine because the Animals can get someone else and they're quite happy and they're not touring as much as what they used to. So he came over to us, which was fantastic, you know, and he's, since he's been on board, it's been wonderful.
Oh, that's great. I remember that brief period where you had, it seemed like a different bass player almost every gig there for a few couple weeks, and I remember seeing some video of Scott, and he was the only one who was just like leaping about the stage while he played. And it was so great to see that, and I thought, that's the guy I hope they pick if they.
Yeah,
if they
oh no, we had Steve. Basically, it was gigs, as you know, the way it works. Gigs are booked months in advance,
right?
And you can either pull that gig, you know, or whatever, and you don't want to pull a gig, you know, especially when people have bought tickets. So. We had a guy, Steve, came in for a couple of gigs. Again, a great bass player, but traditional style bass, you know, whereas want somebody like Tony with a bit of character, which is what Scott's got. But Scott obviously had commitments as well, and Matt had commitments as well. So we ended up working with Steve just for a couple of shows. I mean, it was fine. It was great, but it was like a more of a kind of transition, fill-in kind of period.
Yeah.
But no, we've settled on Scott. We've settled on Scott since he came on board, you know?
Right.
Great stuff.
I think a lot of people don't think Scott's in the band. And to be honest with you, it's perception. Usually, you know, when a band gets together and does something new, there's always like a photo session and stuff like that. We just haven't had the time to do anything like that with Scott, but he is proper full-time member of the band.
Oh, that's good to hear. Good.
All right. So I'll quickly move to a new question, and we have one from Michael Nicholson, and he's kind of asking, let's call it a fan pet question, because the REL session and the REL tapes have a very unique place in most people's hearts, in most fans' hearts. So.
Yep.
I don't foresee that this question has any other answer but no, but I'll ask it. What would be the chances of an REL tour 2017? That would be great to hear over live.
Well, I mean, I think genuine fans of the band would love to hear, you know, certain songs and, you know, slightly obscure stuff and that. And to a certain extent, I would love to do some of the stuff. In fact, I've been talking with Mark about this one. Is when we get around to doing other songs, is looking at some of the Peace in Our Time stuff and making them so you're getting the best of the REL and the best of the Peace in Our Time album, and even combining them. It's like the way we do King of Emotion, we don't do King of Emotion exactly as we did it on the record because it's too bloody slow to play it properly. It's a weird tempo, so we've upped the tempo and we've made the guitars a bit raunchy and it's not got the keyboards or the girl vocals on it, obviously. And I've just kind of done it like we would have done it years ago in a rehearsal room, although we never. So we're talking about, you know, getting some of the REL stuff and amalgamating it with the Peace in Our Time and just trying to come up with a better version, because I think the Peace in Our Time album sounds great. It's Peter Rolfe did a great job in the production, but I just think the song's kind of suffered a little bit, you know?
Yeah. No, it's so interesting that you say that because, I mean, when we get into the album on our show, we'll talk about it more. But I always thought that while I vastly preferred the production sound of the REL stuff, I thought the arrangements on the actual album were sometimes better and more focused and cohesive. So it's almost like, as you're saying that, it's almost like maybe a combination between Peter Wolf's arrangements and the original sound and feel of the REL.
Kind of that, yeah, definitely. I mean, for instance, when we did 13 Valleys, I mean, Stuart plays just a simple acoustic guitar part, really simple, just you know, just roots and fifths. But when we came to record it, Peter said, oh, I do not want you to play the guitar. I want to sample your guitar strings, you know, and it was like, we sampled every note on mine and Stuart's guitars, kind of thing, you know, and then he played them on the keyboard. But it's not like we couldn't play them on guitar. It was just for the effect, and that's what we, you know, that was like the fashionable thing to do in the '80s, all that kind of stuff, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I'm sorry, I'm on a little tangent here, but this is the last thing I'll say about it. But you told us that story when we spoke to you a couple of years ago, and it always reminded me of when I was listening to that album at the time. The track, I don't know how well you remember the track "Everything I Need," but
yeah,
there was an effect in that always. I never could understand how it was done, because it was a picked guitar part, but each string that was picked was panned hard left or right and alternated.
That's right, and it's not a natural guitar part.
I was going to say, yeah, because when you said how he sampled everything, I realized that must be how he did that.
Yeah, that's a complete keyboard part, and it's just basically Peter would get one of us or both of us just to hit an open string, and then he would sample and stick it in the synclavier. But it's kind of unnatural because the sustain and the decays kind of go all the way through like a piano kind of part, and it's just unnatural. But also what he got us to do was, because it sounded unnatural, but that was the effect he was going for, he would get us to play the guitar part but with a left hand, but not actually finger the strings. So you actually got the buzzes on the strings when you're moving your fingers about to make it sound a bit more human.
Oh my god.
But then again, it's like, well, yeah, I'm just going to take my head out of my bum now, you know, because it's just, can't I just bloody well play it, you know? But it was just the effect, you know?
That's amazing. My goodness.
But you got complete separation, and it did sound great, you know?
So maybe for the convention, we could hope for a bit more of that for Ariel stuff and the rarer stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think when we look at the convention, it's going to take a bit of time to rehearse it, obviously. But I think there are, again, speaking with Mark about this, there's definite songs on later albums that should be revisited. I mean, I'll tell you right now, we're never going to go and do an anniversary of No Place Like Home or Peace in Our Time. There's no point in doing that. But there are songs from the later half, if you like, songs that need to be looked at again. And I think we'll definitely be doing that, you know, but it's what you call the tour, or what, you know, that it's like you need something to hang it on. Mm-hmm. But we will be definitely looking at that, as well as hopefully some new stuff as well. But, you know, it's, you can't predict the future, so let's see what happens. But the band are definitely up for doing that kind of stuff.
Great stuff.
It's almost like taking the best bits out of No Place Like Home, the best bits out of Damascus, the best bits out of Buffalo Skinners, and doing stuff like that, you know?
Okay, so here's a question from a Twitter user. Don't know the name. It's Elcor Mako. He has an interesting question, I think. He says, is there a song that even now, when you play it live, you kind of get lost in it, that it takes you away, and you're just lost in the actual music and playing it?
Oh, God, that's a kind of hard one to answer that one. I don't get lost in it. We're just very enthusiastic about what we do, and kind of getting lost in it. Kind of sounds like if we've got a psychedelic track.
Right, right.
Tripping out to or something like that. I don't think I can actually answer that one, to be honest with you.
But, okay, no, that's good. That's all right.
All right.
So you're not, you know, looking up into the sky with your eyes closed, waving your head back and forth. And
maybe Kansas is a bit like that, actually.
Oh, that's cool. Right.
In fact, that's what I'm talking about. The version of Kansas that we actually play live is basically the No Place Like Home and the Buffalo Skinners combined. We've taken what we think is the best bits out of both those albums.
Hmm.
Including some of Mark's drum fills, and mixed them up with his favourite Simon Phillips drum stuff. And got on the original version, I was playing acoustic guitar, and I'm kind of playing the acoustic guitar part electrically. And, you know, it's kind of getting the best of both worlds, and that's what we've done with Kansas.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I love that approach. That's so cool.
Hmm. Maybe I can turn that last question around and say, when you look out to the audience, is there a song you play where suddenly you see the audience standing like that?
Eggplant.
Hair waving, eyes closed, hands to the skies.
Yeah, what's your favorite Big Country songs? Look Away and Eggplant.
They're almost the same ilk.
Here's something you don't know. Eggplant, there was actually a 12-inch mix eggplant, but we had to edit it down.
Oh my lord! Well,
can you imagine that?
You have now put something out there that will become more sought after than the Robin Miller Sear mix.
Ooh,
it's a quest, I tell you.
A petition.
I think Mark's got the master in his bedroom. I think
so. A petition is being created as we speak.
Why does he keep it in his bedroom? Maybe I don't want to know.
No.
Oh gosh, let's quickly rush to another question, and we have a Canadian on our list who goes by the name of Abner Devereaux, the mad scientist from an ancient Kiss movie. He's asking, what is your earliest and fondest memory of Timmins, Ontario? That's assuming you have a memory of it.
Well, the only memories that I've got since I left there when I was 18 months old, the only memories I've got are old photographs that my parents have, and it's stuff like my pram had like skis on it, you know, because the snow was so thick, so mum and dad would be wandering about with snowshoes pushing a pram, and instead of it having the wheels, it had skis.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
And a ridiculous bowl cut. It's like my mum used to put a mixing bowl, cake bowl on my head, just cut my hair, you know.
I think many of us had that done.
Yeah, I don't remember much of it apart from photographs.
Oh, that's great. All right, so kind of maybe going back to your formative years a little bit, this question. Was there ever a band for you that if you had the access to the technology back then, you would have considered making a podcast about? I mean,
definitely. Something like, I don't know, Sensational Alex Harvey Band would have to be. I mean, that was my main band. I loved that band.
Nice. And you were big into The Clash too, as I recall. I mean, at least you've often cited White Man and Hammersmith Palais.
Yeah,
as one of
I mean, The Clash as well. I mean, really, the Clash were, I think, one of the ultimate bands for me. You know, just everything about them I kind of liked. You know, they were great, fantastic band. A little bit of Mott the Hoople in there as well.
Yeah.
I must admit, I do like The Damned's first album as well. That was the one that kind of kicked off for me. And even the name, The Damned, I just thought was, what a brilliant name for a group. The Damned.
It is. I was always surprised, to be honest, that you never recorded a Clash cover.
No, we just never did it, you know?
You did perform one, though, solo, I think, didn't you? Didn't you do White Man?
I did a little recording of White Man.
Yeah, I'm sure I heard that.
Fields of Fire, Stuart would sing a little bit, Should I Stay or Go, Should I Go as well.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was like a little fun tribute kind of thing, you know?
Well, I've often likened your voice to Joe Strummer's, so I think it lends itself well to those kinds of songs.
Yeah, my voice is very much, and I wouldn't call it a singing voice, but it's kind of in between Joe Strummer and Bob Dylan, somewhere in there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love it. I love it.
There's one which is, I won't put a name to it because this touches on a lot of them, so I'll summarize it like this. The rarities. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't have them. A lot of people want to have them. They're out of print. Is there any hope?
Again, they were released on Track Records. I have absolutely no idea how people could get kind of official copies of that unless they buy them for sums of money on eBay. I mean, it would be great for them to come out again in some form or other. It'd be great if they could all come out at the one time, the whole caboodle at a right price, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I can't answer that one honestly because it's Track Records. And I don't really know what's happened there, so...
I thought that track went out of commission.
I think so, but I don't know enough about it.
Yes, it lies with Ian somewhere, is the answer.
Probably.
Yeah.
But I can't honestly answer that. But I mean, right. It's a shame because there's some rarity stuff. There are some gems and golden nuggets. They're not all great. They're not all great, but there is some good stuff on the rarity series.
Yeah, no doubt.
The worst thing about the rarities thing, and again, it was a quality control. Restless Natives was printed at completely the wrong speed. I don't know if any of you guys have noticed that, but Tom, if you pick up a guitar and try and play Restless Natives, you'll notice you're probably a semitone out It's
oh, really?
It's at the wrong speed. It's too fast.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So you had one that was too fast, and then back in the day you had Fly Like an Eagle that was too slow.
That was too slow, yeah.
But it wasn't as fast as Fly Like an Eagle is slow.
No, that was, I think that was a full tone down, whereas I think Restless Natives is about a semitone up. And you can really notice it because Mark's snare drum sounds really high. I mean, it's almost like, sounds like Stuart Copeland's snare. It's just really high, and it's like, oh, what's going on here? And I played along with it. I went, it's been mastered at the wrong speed.
Oh, man. That's amazing that happened.
But I think it was done right on the remaster of the CEO that came a couple of years ago, where you had part one and part two.
Right, I'll check that out eventually. But I do remember the first one that did come out.
Yeah.
I was definitely at the wrong speed because I was having to learn Restless Natives to go and do it with Tony and Mark. And I just went, what the hell's going on here? Like, the drum sound was just too, it was just too high.
Well, you know, on that Seer, the most recent one that Svein just referenced, Svein, help me out with this because I kind of know it, but I'm sort of forgetting the title. There was a version that was called Run With Me.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about why that title was called Run With Me? Or
I have not got a clue.
Okay. Interesting. I was just curious if maybe that was an early...
Someday Universal just obviously came up with a title. unless of course maybe on the tape box it might have had something like that written on it, but
right
just to distinguish it from another song. So I don't know.
Okay, well, the one thing that I wanted to ask about, and I know there's hardly any news about this yet, so it's very much in the early, you know, gathering part of getting this together, but the Skids 40th reunion was recently announced. I mean, I know there's not a lot to talk about yet, but I mean, what can you say about it at this point?
Well, basically, it's the 40th anniversary of the Skids, and I think Richard was approached to do some festival stuff last year, but obviously, you know, it was too short notice. So he got in touch with the guys, and basically all the guys are quite keen to do it. So dates are kind of being booked at the moment.
John's
sanding in the background, is it?
Not me.
John.
So yeah, they're looking at doing some getting some dates booked just now. So I think that's going to be a good fun thing, you know.
Okay, excellent. All right, so Bruce, first of all, before we go any further, I mean, how are you doing on time? Are you doing all right?
I'm cool. I mean, we've only been at this for about an hour, so we only have three more to go. Come on, lads, keep it up. Keep going.
Oh, that's
good. You're worst at me.
All right, let me ask you this. Since we talked about Scott a little bit, let's talk a little bit about Simon, because I think people don't – he's probably the one member of the band right now that people have heard the least from. I mean, what are your feelings of working with him? How's he been doing? I mean, all I can speak on is his singing ability, which sounds great. I mean, he sings the songs wonderfully. So what's he like from your perspective working with him?
I mean, it's great for us because that's all he wants to do. He's only interested in singing. And it's great for us because Mike was a different kettle of fish. Mike was a complete sort of, like almost like a Springsteen Bono kind of showman kind of school, you know? Stuart wasn't like that. Stuart was more of a musician. Simon's kind of like that. Simon's just, he's not into like the big gestures or any of that kind of stuff. He just likes singing. He just loves to sing. And that's basically it. That's what he likes doing, and that's what we require from him. But I think a lot of people expect like vocalists in bands or the lead vocalist to be like the main man. That, you know, the leader kind of thing. And Simon, he's not that kind of guy. It's like almost like his voice is the instrument, you know. It's like, I suppose it's like The Who, you know. It's Roger Daltrey is a vocalist, but it's kind of Pete that does all the interviews and all that kind of stuff and the statements and that. And Simon's he's just a quiet guy, and he just loves singing. And his range is very similar to Stuart's, what I call Stuart's first voice. First three albums, Stuart had a kind of lower register, and then once we got to Peace in Our Time, his voice kind of changed, and it had a few more sort of Americanisms in it. And Simon's got a really wide range, but there's a certain timbre in his voice that does sound like Stuart's first voice. And Simon's not really interested in doing, you know, he does his own thing. He's got like a, I think it's an acoustic project that he's got out at the moment. He's working on that, and he's just quite happy, just, you know, coming along and singing, you know.
Well, I hope I get a chance to see him one of these days. So,
oh,
we'll
hopefully,
see.
You never know, we might get out your neck of the woods.
That would be great.
All right, we have a question from Lee Watterson, who is asking what your favorite lyric of Stewart's was.
Oh, I really like Inwards. I just love all that scouts in the stairwell kind of thing, you know. It's just even Poor Old Man. There's some. I mean, there isn't actually that many lyrics in Poor Old Man, but I do like them. I prefer when Stewart's singing about something that's not black and white, you know, and it's a bit, you know, you've got to think about it. Whereas, you know, some like Republican Party Reptile, it's obvious, you know, or what are you working for? But I prefer some of the, you know, even some of the stuff off the Seer, or some, you know, you've just got to think about it, and they're kind of open to interpretation anyway. And there's stuff that's just a collection of words, you know.
I'm totally with you on that. His more abstract poetry is the kind of stuff that I always, you know.
And sometimes a song doesn't have to mean anything, you know. It's like David Bowie would do that cut and paste kind of thing years ago, you know. It doesn't make sense, but it works, you know. And it's, I think as long as the overall song works, you know, then that's a bonus, you know. It's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. And as an extension of that, do you remember if Stewart was particularly pleased with one of his own lyrics?
I think In a Big Country. Mm. I think definitely In a Big Country.
Yeah, that's the one that he mentioned when I and some other people met him in Nashville. We asked him that question, and that was the one he said. He said, I'm not expecting to grow flowers in the desert, was his favorite lyric. And
No, I mean, it's just great. There's, you know, every line in that song is just amazing.
Yeah, it is. Yep. Okay, so here's kind of a gear question for you from someone named Josh Perry. He's saying, where and when did you obtain your first Yamaha SG, and why did you choose it?
I've got my Yamaha SG500, the red one, and I bought that from Sandy Muir's record shop, which is a record and music shop in Dunfermline, and Sandy Muir used to manage the Skids. Stuart always played like a Gibson Marauder, and then I guess when they got their advance money in, I'm assuming they bought the Yamaha SG 2000 he got. I liked the 500. I never knew too much about guitars back then, but I found out later that the reason I liked the SG 500 more than the 2000 was because it was a glue-in neck, whereas the 2000 was like a straight through neck and it was laminated and it lost some of the sustain. So basically Yamaha had to put a brass sustain bar under the bridge just to help sustain. Whereas my 500, I always kept, even though I had a 2000, I kept going back to the 500 because I just preferred the sound of it. I don't know, one of the reasons I suppose I got it is because, you know, I noticed Stuart had an SG 2000 and they were really popular at the time. I think Midgeur was playing one, Jake Burns was playing one, Bill Nelson obviously, and just a lot of interesting guitar player. Obviously Santana, although I wasn't really into Santana back then, I didn't know enough about him. And I used that guitar, the 500, I used it on probably about half of the Crossing, and in fact I turned it into a mandolin and I made it an octave mandolin. I used that on Come Back to Me. That isn't a mandolin, it's actually the Yamaha SG500. And then come the Seer period, where we could actually afford Les Pauls, we sold the Yamahas, and mine's ended up going down to Sound Control in Newcastle, and I just got it back a couple of years ago, and I've kept it, and I'm going to bring it back out for the Skids, definitely.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Good to hear. Yeah, I remember seeing you guys with the Les Pauls, and that made an impression on me on the Seer because I thought, wow, they're playing Les Pauls now.
That's only because we had the money to buy them. I think the Yamahas were always seen as like a poor man's Les Paul, but the construction of the Yamaha SG is just meticulous. It's amazing, and they do sound good. I mean, I think they called them Les Paul killers for a while, but I think in the 70s, like Fender, like a lot of American guitars, the companies had all been sold, and you know, they was run by accountants, and it was more to do with numbers and keeping the cost down, as opposed to the original quality of the Fenders and Gibsons that had been out in the 50s and early 60s. And that's why people turned to Japan, and because the Japanese were actually building, you know, American style guitars, but doing them better and cheaper. You know, maybe the electronics weren't as good, but at the time you'd find that, I think, DiMarzio, Mighty Might made pickups back in the 70s, and you would exchange them for the NAF pickups, you know, like brands like Anturia and stuff like that. Fantastic guitars. And the Yamahas, they were a lot cheaper than the Les Pauls, and they were probably better than the Les Pauls at that period of time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, excellent, excellent. Good. That'll satisfy some of the gearheads out there.
Yeah,
for sure. I have a question from Mark Dunwillows, and this is similar to some questions we already asked. Mark remembers you self-releasing stuff like the Demology stuff. And he's asking if you would consider releasing perhaps some of the reference materials, guitar parts, demos you might have on your own, on a self-distributed CD.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Do you mean demos of big country songs and stuff like that?
I think, again, this is people getting fascinated by the guitar parts that you shared in the past and that we played on the show.
Oh, right. Well, maybe it's a kind of thing that Jamie and I should think about doing, is just, you know, maybe going into a proper studio and just, you know, coming up with the guitar parts. But I certainly wouldn't release them as in, you know, a proper release. I'd probably just, you know, let people download them on YouTube, or maybe even do a little video so people could see what we're doing with our fingers and stuff like that. I think one of the last ones that Jamie put up, somebody had kind of complained, well, I can't see their fingers. It was like, oh, I never realised they were wanting to work out how to play it. We were just, it was a more of an off-the-cuff thing. But maybe Jamie and I should do that, you know, just go into a studio and, you know, just, you know, put the original track down, say for instance it was Steel Town, and we'll just play on top of Steel Town and then just take the track off. Then you can, guitar players can maybe see, that are interested in that kind of thing, can maybe see what we're playing. It's actually not that difficult. It sounds more complicated than what it is. But there's a lot of effects involved and stuff like that as well.
Mm. I think people would be interested if you wanted to sell a small run off those. I think people would be very interested indeed. So I don't think you needed to do it just for YouTube. I think people would love to have them, especially me. I would love to purchase stuff like that.
Oh, okay, no. £10,000, it's yours. No, I think the way it is nowadays, it's just, I think people, especially younger people now, that become accustomed to getting stuff for free and stuff like that. So, no, I certainly wouldn't want to me, it would be more a labour of love kind of thing. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't want to go down that route.
One of our listeners named Kara, first off, she wanted to know how she can get some of your solo work with Jamie, because she says she only has another Anthem for the Damned and she wants to get more of it and doesn't know exactly how. So
it's already been taken care of.
Oh, it has? Okay.
Yes, it has.
Oh, good for you. You're good. Yes. You're a good man. Well, what? Right.
Well, she's a Jersey girl, so I got to take care of her.
Well, oh, well, then I'll leave that in your culpable hands, then, John.
Well, Bruce, if someone else is listening to this and they want this, I mean...
yeah, contact John.
Yeah, right.
I'm a lazy son.
Well, I'll tell you what, like, leave a message on our Facebook page, listeners, if you want Bruce's and Jamie's stuff, and someone will hopefully pick up on it and figure something out.
There's only really the one recorded album, Another Anthem for the Damned, and then there's the live album, and there's a couple of other bits and bobs, but it's really only the two main albums as such, the live one and the Anthem for the Damned.
Yeah, don't commit me to anything. I have to check to see what I have in stock.
Yeah, John will supply it for you. And John will pay shipping.
No. I think Gordon takes some out on the road with him anyway, so.
Oh, good, okay. Well, they are definitely without a doubt worth getting. Great stuff on there.
Oh, thank you.
But here's the second part of this, and I don't know if you're aware of this, Bruce, but apparently there's another Bruce Watson, and if you search iTunes here in America, at least, you come up with Bruce Watson. Now, here's the strange thing. The bio of this Bruce Watson matches up with you perfectly. Canadian-born Bruce Watson began his career as the guitar player in the Stuart Adamson-fronted Big Country, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now it goes through at the bottom and it says, apart from his work in Big Country, Watson is also in demand as a studio musician.
And, nope.
And now, well, the thing that's amazing is that it's got the albums from this guy, Bruce Watson, and he's got seven albums named Bruce Watson. Albums such as, let's see, what are some titles here? Well, here's one of the titles of one of his songs. My Pussycat Keeps Peeing on the Carpet by Bruce Watson from the album A Moving Feast.
Moving Feast.
That's the name of his album. Here's another song from that album, Dad's Clothes.
I love it.
Unfinished Business, Landlubber's Shanty.
So, well, that sounds great. That could almost be like an outtake from, I don't know, The Storm or something like that.
Well, he's got another one here, an album called Unsung Heroes of Australian History. And this is a little tie-in to you because you have a song called Edison's about Edison, Thomas Edison, and he's got a song here that says The Man and the Woman and the Edison Phonograph.
My God. Have you heard anything yet, no?
I have not heard any of it yet. I need to. I literally just clicked on this while we've been talking because I wanted to check it out. But literally, this guy has...
I'm strangely intrigued by this.
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, the bio of this Bruce Watson is your bio, but the albums are clearly not yours.
Brilliant.
But his name is Bruce Watson. So anyway, I was curious if you might be aware of that. He also has an album here called Afro-Cuban Lullaby. But, no, actually, that's the song.
The other Bruce Watson got in touch with me via John's site, didn't he, John? The guy from...
Guy from Foreigner.
From Foreigner.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. John mentioned that.
And he sent me an email, so I just sent an email back, and it was just quite a fun thing, eh? And then I was like, but even stranger with Foreigner, they've got a guy in the back called Mick Jones, and it's like, it's very confusing because you've got Mick Jones for the Clash as well.
That's
and
right.
two Bruce Watsons. It's a bit strange, but at least we've kind of acknowledged each other now.
Well, this guy has quite a discography. Politics, Religion, and Sex is another album with a song called Save the Hippie.
Save the Hippie.
And the final song title I'll throw out there at you from this same album is called, I kid you not, The Sperm.
What, just that?
The Sperm, not The Storm, The Sperm.
I thought you meant the song was called I Kid You Not.
Oh, no, no.
That'd be a better title.
That would have been much better. That would have been much better. You're right. I Kid You Not, The Sperm. No, it's just The Sperm.
I'm going to sing a song now. With me is the main topic. So let me introduce myself. I'm a cell that's microscopic. I look just like a tadpole, or a little like a worm. I think you should have guessed it by now. Yes, I'm a sperm. I don't know if I'll end up as a woman or a he-man. And I don't know much about sailing, but I like to mix with seamen.
Oh, man, that's genius. Absolutely genius.
So, people out there, if you're looking at the American people, if you're looking for Bruce Watson albums on iTunes and you've stumbled on this stuff, hopefully you figured out that is not Bruce Watson.
That's not me.
Not the one you want, anyway.
No, John, send me those CDs.
Yeah, I'm in it. It sounds good.
All right, that's all I had. It's fine. Do we have any left? Any questions left?
I think we have one from Stuart Stevens, who is asking, we touched on it a bit earlier, but this breaks it down a bit more. And he says, from experience, I know how hard it is to get everyone together for rehearsals. How much time do you get together for, and how is it structured? And you mentioned already the you all rehearse individually.
Yes, that's how we do it. I think I must have, I probably answered that question then, because that's exactly how we do it. It's basically homework, and then we get together in a rehearsal situation for 2 days, and it's basically how we're going to start the song, how we're going to end it, and who's going to do harmonies. You know, what we spend more time on the vocals usually than the music, because you've done that in your house,
right? So how long is the together time of all this?
Well, for instance, next week we'll get together down in the north of England, which is obviously the middle point in the country, down in Clitheroe. We'll go down there and we'll probably rehearse for approximately 4 hours the first day. Then the next day we'll do another 4 hours. And then on the last day, it's usually just Jamie and I and Mark, and Mark will be tidying up a few things, and Jamie and I will be like programming delay units and different effects and stuff like that. Because the last thing you want to do is start programming, takes a bit of time, and other people just get bored if they're not involved. So on the last day, it's usually programming and just tightening up the set lists. And also, we need to make to work out which song should go into the next song. You didn't want songs that are really in the same key going into the song after, if it's in the same key. So I don't think we'll be doing the album in sequential order. At least not the first half. The second half we may do. Steel Town, we did it in sequential order, but I don't think we'll do it on the Seer, although we will be playing all 10 tracks. I mean, the reason an album is sequenced like that, you've got to remember back in those days when it was vinyl. I mean, obviously CD was in its infancy back then, but you were kind of limited to so many minutes per side. And if your album was lopsided, you know, the quality would suffer as well, you know. So that's the reason that the albums were sequenced back then as well, was just to get the times kind of evened out, so it was kind of similar on both sides. But in my head, it's like I've got a kind of idea of what to start with.
And what you said there reminded me of the track listing on the original album, which the printed track listing was actually different than the actual one.
All right.
And I remember it started with Dileden, which for some reason, the printed one. And guys, help me out here. I don't remember top of my head, but it was a very different track listing.
I don't remember that. I don't remember that, but I'm sure you're right.
In some countries it was correct, some countries it wasn't.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that different countries had different kind of similar looking sleeves, but there was always slight variations and stuff like that.
Well, that brings up a question I've had, Bruce, and this is kind of a obscure type of question, but you'd mentioned earlier the lyrics to Inwards being ones that you really like, the Scouts in the Stairwell. I remember when that came out, the lyrics for that were printed in the sleeve differently than what Stewart sang. They were initially
there was a few. Are you talking about on the crossing on the little white label inside? Yeah, there was a few that were.
And like, for example, that was the Scouts in the Stairwell will kiss again. And then the actual recording was the Scouts in the Stairwell will meet again. And there were some other examples of that. I'm just curious if you had any memories of Stewart rewriting those or all about. It is it a matter of that you just sent it to the printer before he changed the lyrics?
Completely, absolutely no mystery. Stewart would have written them down by hand. The girl in the office would have copied them, and she would have typed it on a word processor, not even a computer, and some things just were just wrong. And there was no sort of mystery to that. It was just basically typos.
Okay. Do you have any problems? Like, anyone have any problems deciphering some of Stewart's lyrics when you go back to these albums if you don't actually have the official lines? Or is that pretty easy?
I think because the diction was quite good anyway, I think we can make them out. And obviously, with Stuart's accent, very similar to my accent, I can tend to pick things out as well.
Right.
But there's always, you always get stumped on something. You know, you always think, oh, this, it was that he said that, but in actual fact, he didn't say that.
I mean, right.
I mean, a classic example was we had a guy. He's no longer with us, big guy that used to look after us, called Joe Seabrook. He used to work with Keith and Ronnie for the Stones. He used to look after them. And he turned up, we were sitting in the bus one night, and Big Joe sitting there with a couple of drinks and playing cards and whatever, and he goes, what's a Scorpius? And I went, Stuart's looking at me, and I'm like, Stuart, what? He goes, what is a Scorpius? Is it some sort of mythical sort of minotaur or a creature? And Stuart's going, what song's that? And he went, you know that song, you know, is it Close Action, you know, A Score of Years, blah, blah. And he thought it was called A Scorpheus, a Scorp- because of Stuart's accent. A Scorpheus, do-do-do-do.
A Minotaur.
A Scorpheus. But it's great because it's like, it became part of her dictionary.
So funny.
Here comes a Scorpheus. You know?
Well, I think I mentioned this on an earlier show, but back with the Seer, one of the early versions I bought of that on CD, there was a typo in the, imagine that, in the lyrics of the teacher. And instead of she wove the tail in silken curls, it was tail was spelled T-L-A-E. So for a number of years, I thought, it was like Tlay, and I thought it was some Scottish thing that I wasn't aware of. So I I would think, what is a Tlay? I need to find out what that is. She wove the Tlay in silken curls, but
Great. I love all that stuff because they kind of become legitimate and real, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the reason Big Joe said that Scorpheus is because he'd asked Stuart about what's this Poro Man thing, you know, and then Stuart. And explain the joke. It was like an H.G. Wells short story, Pollock and the Poro Man, about some sort of African witch doctor thing. And they just assumed that, you know, Poro Man, or Scorpheus, it must be from the same book.
Now, did Stuart, when he was writing lyrics, I mean, did he usually keep those really close to the vest before he was finished, or did he ever discuss them with the band as you were working out songs?
No, I kept them to basically. Most of the time in the early days, the songs were like shadows, instrumentals, kind of without Cliff Richard. So they were always instrumental, and then Stuart would take the instrumental away, and then on a cassette normally, and then he would just, you know, go up to his room, you know, and just write lyrics, and then come back down, and it'd be like, you're going to have to change this, Bruce. It's like, oh no, no, okay. It's like every time you got to change the guitar part because it's going to. The lyric, you know, instrumentally they were great. Like, In a Big Country was instrumental, but when Stuart comes back and puts the lyrics on, you know, he's got to change guitar parts, I've got to change guitar parts, but usually the rhythm section is always the same. But to make it work, the melody, he'd evolved the melody, because I don't think he actually had the melody. He probably had the melodies in his head, obviously, but once you start, you know, once you start singing along, it's like, you know, certain things will work and certain things won't work. So things have to change. It's like the next day, right, Bruce, you're going to have to change that guitar line. It's like, oh, no, right. And they will sing it to me. Right, I've got you now. I know what to do now. Yep.
Oh, that's great. Well, man, I mean, I think we've exhausted all the questions for this from the listeners, and I don't think I have any left. Do you have any left, Swine?
I can't think of any, really.
Okay, so I guess the last thing
that's it.
I guess the last thing we'll do is put this to you, Bruce. I mean, do you have I know this is kind of the cliche question to ask, but I mean, do you have anything you want to put out there to the people who are listening to this as to what they can expect in the coming months and what your approach continues to be or your mindset is? And
well, obviously, I'd like to thank everybody for the continued support, and you know, hopefully we can continue the way we're going at the moment. And like I say, it would be great to do some new stuff, but until that happens, I mean, obviously we all want to do new stuff and want to look at some of the rarities and just have to be patient there, you know. So, but as long as people are quite willing to come and see us play and listen to us, then we're quite happy to keep going.
That's fantastic. Well, we're really happy and thankful that you joined us today. And so thanks for giving us your time. We really appreciate it.
All right, now bugger off, you boring bastard.
Would you like to join us on a future what we call deep dive of one of those two albums left? You can talk with us about each track for hours at a time.
Yeah, I'll adopt the John Roll, I think, and just. See, the thing is, if I adopt John Roll, I could actually go and get a haircut, and you wouldn't know, and I'll just come in occasionally and switch the Uber on, and you know, yeah, I'm here, I've listened to everything you've said. It was great. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Fantastic. Like, no worries, guys. Thank you very much for that. It was great.
All right, take care. Have a great night, Bruce.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, guys. Thank you. See you soon, John. Cheers, fine.
Bye.
Fucking prosper, douchebag.
Thank you. six man, first time from Jamaica. Dillinger and Leroy Scott, Delroy Wilson, the cool operator. Ken Booth, a UK pop reggae. Sound system. If they got anything to say, there's many black ears here to listen. But it was for Top Sound night, with encores from stage right, charging from the bass notch to the treble. But on stage they got no roots rock rebel. On stage they ain't got no roots rock rebel. Dress back, jump back. This is a blue beat attack.
Is a Scorpius? Is it some sort of mythical sort of minotaur or a creature?
There's John's dog again.
Get out of here!
The crazy mutt.